tweet at TodaySOR.
My next guest was one of the faces of ITN News in Britain for 30 years, working first as a foreign correspondent and then as an anchor. He has reported and presented from across Europe, the Middle East, Africa, Asia, America, Australia and even Antarctica. In 2017, he joined Sky News as their Washington correspondent. He's home now and presenting the news hour at 5 o'clock every evening on Sky, but he's also trying to fit in time to promote his memoir. It's called And Thank You For Watching. Mark Austin, good morning to you.
Good morning. Thank you very much.
Let's start in Washington. What an interesting time to be going there, just as Donald Trump was taking office. And you're right that what became clear to me after a year of covering this president is that, in fact, there are many Donald Trumps. Tell me about them.
Well, I mean, it was one of those things when Sky said, do you want to go and cover Trump for a year? I thought it was an irresistible offer. And actually, to be honest, I thought, well, I'll go and try and cover this president as I've covered other presidents, as we covered Obama and Clinton and Bush, and, you know, apply the same approach and the same standards. But it very quickly became clear that this was no normal president. This was a president who did things in other ways. And this was a president who had decided that, in fact, he wanted to sideline the mainstream media. So you had to approach it in a very different way. And so effectively what I did was I set my phone alarm for his tweets in the morning. And, you know, 6:30, 7 o'clock every morning, the first Donald Trump tweet of the day would come in and off we'd go. And that would set the tone for the day. And I can't think of any other president who has basically, you know, done his morning ablutions and then sat on the throne and started tweeting out these presidential pronouncements. And I talked about a lot of Donald Trumps because there are a lot of Donald Trumps. There's the Donald Trump who, you know, is a sort of political bully. There's the Donald Trump who's a narcissist. There's a Donald Trump who has identified very cleverly a kind of core support in America among, you know, blue-collar workers who felt disenfranchised and who felt that they were fed up with the political establishment and who wanted someone to speak out for them. And he identified that very cleverly. So there are a lot of Donald Trumps. And I think, you know, what I found out in the end was you don't underestimate Donald Trump. And there's every chance, Sean, that, you know, he could win the election in 2020.
Do you think Donald Trump gets fair treatment from the mainstream US media?
Well, look, he's chosen to sideline the US mainstream media. In fact, I go further. He's chosen to go to war with the mainstream media. And in some ways, you can't blame him, because I've never known a time when sort of mainstream news networks like CNN and MSNBC have been so implacably hostile to a president. And they've chosen to do that. And Donald Trump has decided that he won't get his message across with the mainstream media. So, as I say, he's doing it direct. And he knows that if he can keep his core support, that he will be elected next time, as long as the economy stays as strong as it is.
Obviously a fascinating time for you to be there reporting on his first year in office, but equally, if not more fascinating, returning home to anchor the news hour for Sky, and here you are reporting on the drama that is Brexit.
Yeah, and you know, I was thinking the other day that very similar things have kind of played into these two extraordinary things that are happening in the world. The Donald Trump, what I was just talking about these people feeling disenfranchised and fed up with establishment politicians. You know, it was a very similar thing that happened here. And people, it was almost like a protest vote, the Brexit vote. It was almost as if people said, well, we're fed up with the established way of doing things. And other things played in, of course, immigration played in, the fact that, you know, people didn't like being controlled by a politician, particularly politicians in Brussels. And very similar sentiments, I think, played in 2016 to the referendum here, as they did in 2016 to the election of Donald Trump.
To go right back, though, to the start of your career, Mark, like a lot of people at the time, I think, you didn't go to university. You did a short training course, and then you got that perfect start in journalism with a local newspaper. In this case, one that was made famous by one of its sub-editors, one Bill Bryson.
Yes, it was. I get asked a lot by young students who want to be journalists or think they want to be journalists, you know, do I need to go to university? And I said, well, I didn't. And I knew quite early on that I wanted to be a journalist. And my father said to me, look, if you really know what you want to do, then get on and do it. So I worked for the local paper, and it was full of sort of quite aging and quite aloof sub-editors who sat in their room at the end of the corridor and never came down to talk to us at all. And then one day in walked this young bearded American guy, and he came over to me with my copy, and he had actually come to talk to me rather than summon me to the subs room. And he said, I think we do it another way. Maybe we put a new top on it, and maybe we rewrite the middle, and actually the end's not great, so why don't we rewrite the end? And then I said, well, look, we've never met, I'm Mark. And he said, yeah, I'm Bill Bryson. And he was just setting out on his literary career. And then he went on to write, actually, in one of his books, I think it's Notes from a Small Island, about the Bournemouth Echo, and absolutely captures it brilliantly.
And then you moved initially, I think, into television with the BBC, but you always, I presume, wanted to be out reporting. And what a start, the miners' strike in the 80s.
Yeah, so the first job was the miners' strike, and it was a very bitter dispute, and it was violent, and again there was sort of hatred of the media. You know, they didn't trust the BBC; they thought the BBC was an arm of the Thatcher government. And you know, on one occasion, I can remember getting up when I was working for the breakfast programme, and we got up at 4 a.m. and we went down to where the picketing was taking place, and I was with a cameraman, and they started throwing things at us, and one of the things that landed on my shoulder was a bag of urine just burst on my shoulder, and I thought, what on earth am I doing here? But it was a bitter dispute, and one that was very unpleasant to cover.
I suppose that perhaps maybe helped you solidify the idea of becoming a foreign correspondent. Sport, I think it was, that got you travelling initially. You got to see six Olympics, and you managed to knock several months in Sydney, living in the same hotel as Elton John, as it happened.
Yeah, I mean, I went to cover the America's Cup and an England cricket tour in Sydney, and I'd joined ITN by then. I'd just joined ITN, and I was 28 years old, and they said, go off to Australia and cover England and the America's Cup. And while I was there, there were court cases, and Elton John went into hospital for throat surgery, and it was one story after another. So I was doing general news and sport, and I managed to stay in Australia for about 4 months, and we became resident guests at the hotel we were staying in. And the two other resident guests were Elton John, who had the penthouse suite, and Phil Collins, who had the suite below that. And they used to put the names of the resident guests in the foyer. And there it was, Elton John, Phil Collins, and then underneath Mark Austin and Mike Nolan, who was my producer. And we looked at each other, we thought, we've made it.
I think you were at another Olympics that you probably remember as well, but maybe not for the right reasons, or at least as good reasons. Was that the Seoul Olympics, where you went on TV at short notice, maybe a little the worse for wear?
Yeah, well, what happened was that in those days, in 1988, the Olympics in Seoul, there was a day off in the middle of the Olympics, and ITV were covering the Olympics, and they decided to throw a very big party, and we were all out until about 4 a.m, and then our phones started going, and because Ben Johnson, the sprinter, had been done for drugs, and he'd won the 100 metres, and suddenly he's been done for drugs, and this massive story was breaking, and I was asked to be on the news in about 2 hours' time. And I have to say, I was in a bit of a state, but we did manage to do it, but they wanted me to go live. I managed to do the video report, but they asked me to go live, and the agreement with the newscaster was, what's the latest, you know, bring us up to date, which I thought I could just about handle. And when it came to it, the newscaster said to me, Mark, exactly how many athletes are on drugs? which was not the sort of question that you want at any time, but when you're slightly worse for wear. But I would never do it again. They're very unprofessional. And anybody, young, aspiring journalists, broadcast journalists out there, don't do it.
And a terrifying experience. Now, speaking of terrifying experience, you had very many of them in your work as a foreign correspondent, particularly, say, when you became Africa correspondent. You got to witness some of the pivotal moments in history, both before and after Nelson Mandela's election as president. Take us back there.
Well, one of the great thrills of my life, Sean, was to cover Nelson Mandela and get to know Nelson Mandela and to interview him on a number of occasions. And he was a wonderful man, and he knew that there needed to be reconciliation between the whites and the blacks in South Africa for his new South Africa to work. And it was a foregone conclusion that he would win the election. But there was a lot of violence in South Africa, and particularly a lot of black-on-black violence in the townships and serious criminal violence. But there was also a group of white right-wing extremists under a guy called Eugene Terreblanche, who used to ride around on a horse, and they were determined to stop this move to a new democratic South Africa, a black-run South Africa. And there were protests in one sort of homeland in South Africa where these white right-wingers wanted to maybe even set up their own homeland, and it all got terribly violent, and we went down to cover it. And we got down and we started filming, and they saw that we were filming, and they got out the back of their trucks, and they were quite heavily armed, and they forced me and my producer out of the car, and they forced us into a field in a place called Boputswana, and it was just basically scrubland and bush, and they just walked us into this field and told us to look ahead, and then they put the gun just behind our ears and said that they were going to shoot us, and that was pretty terrifying. And I guess that was the one time, or one of the few times, that I thought that's probably it. But mercifully, someone came along, one of their sort of so-called commanders came along and said, don't do it, just leave them there. And they just sort of pushed us onto the floor. And, you know, you really don't want to die in a place called Boputswana in the middle of nowhere, because no one will remember you.
Or anywhere else. And you've been more fortunate than some of your colleagues, people you've known quite well. You attribute your survival in part, I think, you say it's cowardice.
Well, yeah, I mean, look, there are war correspondents who thrive on that, and they thrive on the adrenaline that covering conflict entails. And I'm not one of those. I am innately a coward when it comes to that. But it's about managing risk, I think. And you go into these war situations and you accept what you're doing, that you're going into a place that most other sensible people want to get out of. But you also accept the risk, and the job is, I think, to minimize that risk, because as a foreign correspondent with a television crew, you also have responsibility for that television crew. And so I did try and minimize the risk. But, you know, I think you may be referring to Iraq in 2003, when I was with Terry Lloyd, my colleague, my ITN colleague, and he was with one crew and we were with another crew, and he decided to go towards Basra when the invasion began in 2003. And I decided to go somewhere else because I was trying to present the program then, and he was a reporter. And he went too far, and he crossed a front line that he didn't realize was a front line, where the American tanks were sort of embedded in the sand, and he didn't see them, and he drove through too far into Basra. And then some Iraqi militia were coming the other way, and they saw these two 4x4 vehicles, which did have press clearly marked, but they saw them, and I think they wanted the vehicles, and they gave chase. So Terry and his crew turned the vehicles round, sort of roared back at high speed towards where they didn't know these Americans were, this sort of front line. And the American young platoon commander saw these vehicles, saw the Iraqi mounted machine gun on one of their vehicles, and just opened fire on all the vehicles. And Terry was killed, and a cameraman, ITN cameraman Fred, was killed. Our fixer Hussein Osman was killed, and they're still missing. Fred and Hussein Osman, imagine this, Fred and Hussein Osman were never found. Their bodies were never found. I mean, these vehicles were basically incinerated.
You have, as we say, covered many, many huge stories, but in many respects, and you write about this in the book, the biggest story of your life turned out to be a personal one involving your eldest daughter, Maddie. Tell me about her and what happened.
Yeah, well, I did think twice about writing about this, but my daughter got very ill. When I was presenting News at 10 on ITV, my daughter got very ill with anorexia, and I didn't deal with it very well as a father. I just thought that anorexia was this, you know, fad, teenage fad, that she wasn't eating, that she would eventually just need, you know, to get over it and start eating again. And I didn't deal with it at all well, and I didn't realise that it was a mental illness. And had I realised it was a mental illness, I would have dealt with it a lot better. But we had this terrible experience, and because the resources weren't there when we required them, and the help for mental health patients, particularly young you know, eating disorder patients just wasn't there. My daughter and I decided when she got better, mercifully, to write about it. But, you know, she very nearly died, and there was not the intervention or the help around. And so that's why we decided to go public, and that's why I decided to write about it in the book. And
you talked about how there was one particular moment you just completely lost patience with her, and at a time when you knew she was in danger of dying.
Yeah, it's very frustrating. We had a terrible relationship during her illness. She was manipulative and conniving and cunning, and just trying to conceal her not eating, and I was trying to, you know, make her eat. And my frustration grew, and I didn't understand the illness. And I did say to her, look, if you really want to kill yourself, kill yourself, go ahead. And of course, I bitterly regret that now, because I know what she was going through, and I know it was a mental illness. But at the time, that's how I felt.
One of the things that comes through the story and the way you write about it, and you and Maddie, is that no matter how much care, how much love, how much attention, how much money you spend on trying to have a cure, there really needs to be a moment when the individual with the anorexia has to decide for themselves they want to live.
Yeah, and that's the crucial thing. And for too many, it comes way too late. And, you know, it's one of the few mental illnesses that has a physical manifestation, that you just get thinner and thinner and thinner. And my daughter, Maddie, just wasted away before my eyes. And she became very painfully, painfully thin and covered in skin sores. And she got brittle bone disease, and she had organ failure. And her basically, she was collapsing and dying in front of us. And she just couldn't bring herself to decide, make the decision to get better. And I wasn't talking to my daughter, Maddie, I was talking to this thing called anorexia. And so I never got through. And it was just pure chance that we found a place that would take her in. She found a nurse that she really liked, a key worker, who was really good with my daughter, and who said to her, look, if you carry on like this, you are going to die, and you've got, you know, two choices. You either do carry on like this, or you make a decision that you're going to live and have a life that's worthwhile. And, you know, mercifully, as I say, she decided that she wanted to get better, and it wasn't too late. But for so many, you know, something like 20% of these people who have chronic anorexia do die either from suicide or from organ failure.
It is one of the many fascinating chapters in an absolutely wonderful book. We've barely scratched the surface, Mark. Thank you so much indeed for talking to us. That is Mark Austin there. The book is called And Thank You for Watching, published by Atlantic Books, priced £20 sterling. Mark, thank you indeed.
Today with Sean O'Rourke on RTE Radio 1.